We're live. Hello, everyone. It is time for the Renegade Society radio live stream, and we are super lucky this week. I am Sarah Erickson, Director of Sales and Marketing, and we have guest Randy Hoyt with us today. He is from Foxtrot Games, and we'll talk more about that in a second. And we also have Steph in the chat room with us. She will be helping us, answering questions, chatting with you guys, and letting us know if you guys have any questions. So we have a great show tonight. We'll be chatting with Randy, and then we're going to do giveaways, so make sure you stick around for that, and then talking about what we have going on at Renegade this week. So Randy, how's it going?
It's great, Sarah. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for coming on our show. So you own Foxtrot Games, right?
Correct. Yes, I'm the owner and game producer here at Foxtrot Games. For those that don't know, we've got, I think, what is it, 6 or 7 products out now, and we've partnered on many of them with you and Renegade. So Lanterns, the Harvest Festival, probably our best known game, and Fox in the Forest is the hot one we have right now.
Yeah, it's crazy. So you've actually been partnering with Renegade and Scott here at Renegade longer than I've been part of Renegade.
That's
so
true.
You win. yeah, it's pretty amazing. So tell us a little bit how that started. So it's kind of a weird story, like Lanterns is something that you found, but now we got involved. So how did that whole thing happen?
Yeah, so I found Lanterns. Christopher Chung designed Lanterns and pitched it to me. I did Relic Expedition was my first game, our first game we put out as a company. And that came out, what has it been now? I guess the very beginning of 2014. And so based on that, and I met Chris Chung on Twitter, and he pitched me a couple of games, including the game that became Lanterns. And so we played it. He and I worked to develop it, hired Beth Sobel to do the artwork, and we got all that ready for Kickstarter in the fall of 2014. And Scott saw it on Kickstarter, is the story I've heard. And he said he wished he had found it and published it from the Kickstarter campaign. So he reached out to me at BGGCon that November. So yeah, November 2014. And we met, we played Lanterns, and he said I would have published this if I'd found it. And we talked about co-publishing. And so He with his network, his background in the industry, he thought he could get it out to a wider audience and distribution. And so we partnered with him after that. So, you know, I got the game all ready to print and then handed over to Scott to manufacture and handle all the retail and distribution and convention promotion side of things. And so after that, we talked about continuing to do more games. And so, you know, I found World's Fair about the same time Lanterns was on Kickstarter. I met Alex at Gen Con, I think right before that. He pitched me World's Fair, signed it, and even before the Kickstarter, talked to Scott about co-publishing that one as well. Since then, we've done a few games that just went straight to retail. So the Lanterns expansion, Fox in the Forest, and Sunday Split, we just went straight to, they were small enough products, we went straight to retail, partnering again with you all at Renegade.
So how did you make that decision? Because it seems like Lanterns did super duper well putting it on Kickstarter first, but then also the Fox in the Forest did amazingly well just putting it straight out into retail. So you mentioned that part of that was that they are small enough, but is that the only decision point when you're thinking about Kickstarter or not? There's a lot that goes into that, I assume.
Yeah. When I started with Lanterns, I did not have the money. I mean, I had savings, I suppose, I could have spent on it, but it was a side hobby. I had a day job, a family, a mortgage, all the wonderful things of modern life. And I really needed the money from Kickstarter to manufacture Lanterns. So I didn't at the time have another choice, really. That was just the model, find a game, run Kickstarter, raise the money to produce it and see what happens. Since then we've made money off of the games, and Kickstarter has changed a lot as well. It's starting to get, it seems like it's more focused on bigger games, medium, heavy euros and miniatures type games. So today, as the market gets more specialized, I think there's fewer games that can really do well on Kickstarter. It's a much more niche kind of platform these days. So that's one big factor. Is it the kind of game that could blow up? Kickstarters are a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of money that you spend on just marketing material that you wouldn't, you know, that don't go into the game. So obviously a lot of the artwork goes into the game, but you got to look at like how much are you spending that's essentially just spending money to try to raise more money. And do you have a game that can return that, you know, really big? Can you get 10, 20, 100 times, you know, if you have any chance at blowing up like that? And the small games, you know, it didn't seem like they had a good shot. A two-player trick-taking game didn't seem like it was the kind of game that, you know, could do $1 million on Kickstarter or even whatever. It's a much smaller price point, so a million would be way out of range, but even 100,000, 200,000 didn't seem very reasonable. And it was small, so the cash flow wasn't an issue. You know, just paying for the art and paying for the manufacturing was very affordable. It was something we could afford to do since, you know, the success of our other games and the smallness of those games. So it seemed like a great fit just to go straight to retail.
Yeah, it seems like it's worked out great on both my end and your end. Yeah. As far as that goes so far, it's been wonderful. Like, I just am in love with Fox on the Forest, and we've been selling that super duper well. And that came out in July of last year.
Yeah, that was July.
And we're on our fourth printing now.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And yeah, so we're in love with that game, and it seems like that was the right call with that one. But it's really tricky. I agree. I think Kickstarter has changed a lot in the last few years. And you recently did Spy Club on Kickstarter, and I'm really super excited for that one to come out. And I know that part of the decision-making process with that one was that you put a crazy amount of money into the artwork in this game.
Yeah, so again, that's another one that's, it was more expensive to get ready for production. So paying for all the artwork, you know, hoping to get some of that cash flow back earlier with the campaign, as opposed to waiting for retail just to be able to keep having cash on hand, to keep making more games. So that was the main driver. And it's a big game. You know, it's the most expensive game I've made by far. The manufacturing is not too much more. It's a little bit more than World's Fair was, but the artwork was definitely a lot more.
Yeah, I do want to talk more about Spy Club in a little bit. I have some cards I want to show off because I finally got my copy. But it's interesting just hearing you talk about the way that you've made these decisions. What do you do as a day job? Because clearly you're very good at the businessy part of this whole industry, and yet you still are co-publishing with us. So like, you must be doing something as a day job that makes that worth keep still doing.
Yeah, so my day job, I'm a computer programmer. So I work at a software company making enterprise software. I'm mostly writing JavaScript. Our application's built in Java on the back end for those who know such things. But yeah, I'm writing JavaScript, Angular interfaces that make, they call REST APIs built in Java.
It sounds like something very useful that I would be sad if it didn't exist, but I don't know that it exists now.
Yes, that's fair. And my background is, my undergraduate degree was in philosophy, which is not businessy, but I guess it's a similar logical thinking type flow that programming is. But I also got a degree from the business college, so I have a master's in MIS, which is where computers and business interact. Suppose is how you describe that. So that's my background, programming and businessy type things.
That makes sense. So you've gotten to see pretty much every part of this industry now, because you started out as a publisher. You've worked with all the artists, you've done the marketing yourself for parts of it. And then with Spy Club, you're actually the designer of this game. Yeah. So out of all of these different things that you've done, what do you enjoy the most about this industry?
I definitely enjoy the game development. So the game is already, you know, the core idea has been set, the vision's been cast, and it's more or less fun. And then trying to squeeze that last 5 or 10% of fun out of it. That's, you know, it's a scientific type methodical process, but you are trying to produce repeatable, predictable, fun outcomes in kind of an artsy way. And so for me, that's a really good mix of art and science, of logic and beauty, to just try to, in that space of game development. Designing from scratch is hard. I mean, I did design the first game we did, Relic Expedition. You know, Spy Club is a co-design. Jason Kingsley is the other designer. And a lot of the core ideas were his. He and I talked really early on about brainstorming ideas for the game. And he did a lot of that sort of initial development or the initial design, getting the game where it worked and was fun. And then I stepped in and designed the campaign system, And we had a lot of people designing the campaign content, but getting that system and developing the core game into what it is was my main contribution there.
Makes a lot of sense. I can definitely see your touch on this because everything is very logical in the way that it flows. So let's talk a little bit about Spy Club. So how would you explain this game to people who haven't gotten a chance to play it yet?
All right, Spy Club. I love that real cover. I just got my first copy off the line as well. So as far as timing, we're hoping to have it out Kickstarter backers this summer, June, and at Origins is kind of the plan. But yeah, I just got my copies today. Yay. It's Spy Club is a cooperative game. You're playing neighborhood detectives solving, you know, neighborhood crimes. Things like eavesdropping or lying or theft are the kind of crimes that are happening. It's cooperative, so you're working together. You're all playing detectives trying to solve this mystery. The mystery that comes out is organic, so there's not like a preset story or a preset deck. You're using actions to manipulate your hand of cards. You're flipping them. They're double-sided. They have clues on both sides. And you're flipping them, trading them, confirming them to the center, manipulating all your hands, doing with action points and cooperative trading and things to figure out this mystery. And so you'll solve one aspect at a time. There's five aspects to each case, each game you'll play. There's the crime, the suspect, the motive, the location, and the object. And as you solve each one, a story starts to emerge. So, you know, if there's a theft at the mansion, involved the cashier. Well, what was he doing? What did he steal? There's a bunch of objects. Maybe he stole a hat. And the game really leads you to tell an organic story. So every game, you know, a different story will emerge. And the art from Bartomiej Kordowski, he did Dream Home. That's probably what he's most famous for right now. It's just so detailed and so many little hidden gems to kind of help bring out that story so that players can start to tell that story together. And as you solve these, you can play a single standalone game where you solve one case with the five aspects, but it's meant to be a campaign game. And we've got a campaign system where each campaign is five games. So a game will take 30, 45, maybe 60 minutes to play. And after each game, you'll unlock a new module or a new set of rules. And the game comes with 40 modules. And in a campaign, you'll unlock four of them. So these will, you know, radically alter the kinds of things that you're doing. You're still trying to solve a mystery, but sometimes it's altered how you do it. Sometimes you'll get extra actions. You'll get extra tasks you have to complete. Alongside of it, you'll get a new way to solve the case. So instead of trying to get five cards that go together, you're trying to, well, I won't spoil anything too much, but you're trying to do different things to solve these aspects. And they're all really, you're solving a master case. So each case has five aspects, but the campaign as a whole has five aspects. So you might solve, oh, there's this master eavesdropping case going on. So then you unlock a module that's related to eavesdropping. So there'll be some sneaking around, some overhearing that might be going on, things related to eavesdropping. And every case is different. So there's a carnival you'll have. If you unlock the carnival, you'll have different mechanics there. And they're not just flavor. I mean, they will give you story elements that emerge. There's also like really fundamentally different mechanics. So things will change. Things that you were already using now have a new significance, or there's a new action you can take, you know, things like that. So you'll play a whole campaign. You'll see four of the 40 modules, and then you can reset everything. You put it all back in and you can start another campaign. So you can play 10 campaigns if you want before you'll see everything in the box, but you can play a campaign with one group and, you know, your core gaming group, but then you could teach it to another family and that you could play, you know, your whatever eighth module with them. They'll have seen four, you'll have seen eight, they can get a copy and then they can play their own campaign. Everybody's campaigns will be different. They're not pre-scripted, so it's not like you always have the eavesdropping module and the carnival module together. So everybody will get a very different mix. And so the way that things emerge together will be, you know, lots of surprises, fun and delightful, and everybody's story will be different.
So I actually got a chance to play this weekend, and I played some like preview games with you while you were in the middle of development. And basically when I played the preview games, you just learn how the basic mechanics worked. And it was a very puzzly game. So you're working together, you have these cards in front of you, you're trying to share and trade and be really efficient with your actions and try and get everything to fit the puzzle the way it's supposed to. So that part of it's enjoyable, but until this weekend, I hadn't gotten to play any of the campaign aspects of it. And I love the way that that works because you play through it once and you understand how everything works and you feel like it's really simple and straightforward, even though, you know, it's still a good challenge. But then you add the campaign stuff and it completely changes everything that you were doing. Suddenly, instead of trying to solve 5 cards and have them all be the same color, now you have 9, but they're set up like a Rubik's Cube. There's just totally crazy stuff that happens. And so it makes you want to go on to that next game every time, because at the end of each game, you're going to unlock something that says, okay, now the next game that you play is going to be different in this way. Go try it. So I think that that is a really smooth transition. It really makes you want to keep using this. And like you said, it's crazy how much content's in this box and how absolutely gorgeous it is. Yeah. I was just blown away by the artwork. And I think that the basic rules are easy enough that I could play this with my cousins and my nieces and nephews who are, you know, 6 and 7 years old. I could easily play this with my gaming group. We have a Saturday afternoon campaign group where we only play campaign style games. Like, I can't wait to bring this and play that with them. And I just really like that it works for so many different people and that you get so much value out of this box. Like, it's only a $40 game, which is also 40, really surprising.
45 is the retail.
Oh, 45. I'm sorry. Sorry. Yeah. And that's like so much good stuff in this box for what you get out of it. And I like all the little details too. Like, this is not quite organized how it's supposed to be, but you have this little card box that holds the deck of cards. So you're pulling everything out of here, which is really nice. You've got just a humongous bag of tokens, and you don't even know what all these things do when you start. Like, most of these are going to be things that you have to unlock to be able to even use. And then you've also got just these 2 massive campaign decks. Like, this is just one of them. And you've got another whole campaign deck of cards that you don't even know what they do yet at all, which is super fun.
Yeah, it's 174 cards in the campaign deck, you know, and it's 40 different modules that you'll unlock one game at a time. Again, in your order will be different than anybody else's order that you unlock them in.
And like you said, it's not that you are solving a particular mystery that's always going to have the same answer. Yeah. You end up telling a story that you can share with your friends. Like, remember that time when there were the guys who stole the hats from the mansion, and then after that we had to go to the park, and so you end up telling your own story. And I actually read an article that you wrote about this that hasn't been published quite yet, but you mentioned one of the things I was impressed about was that you mentioned the way that you made the artwork was specifically designed so that there would be a lot of stuff going on in there, so that you could look at this card and decide what element of that you wanted to grab onto. Like, this is a diner, and maybe you're excited that it's a green diner, but maybe you're really excited about that huge stack of pancakes. So you can incorporate that into the story that you want to tell, so that by the end of it, and you have your 5 elements that you've discovered, then you can say, well, we were eating pancakes in the diner, and then this thing happened, and do it the way you want to do it, which is just fun. Or if you don't want to do that, you can ignore that part of it, but it gives you the option.
Yeah, and it's worth noting too that all 40 modules are fully replayable. There's no, like, there's no deduction in them where once you've played a module, you've solved it or you've done it. There are some surprises, and obviously you can only get surprised once from it, but they all can be played over and over again, even within the 40. So you have 40 times however many times you want to play it. So yeah, infinite replayability, one person said during the Kickstarter campaign.
I also like the way that you did the character cards. So like, this is a character that I want to play. So you actually included this whole sheet of stickers so that you can put your own name on that card later if you're going to replay this. And you can just keep putting that sticker on top and play with whoever you want. So that way, even if the last time somebody played this, they were playing as Annie, well, maybe I want to play as Jacqueline. I can do that.
Yeah, we really wanted to make sure everything was reusable, since the whole point of the game is you can reset it, you can play again, it will be different. And even if you get the same modules, it's still a different experience, and just to not have anything that got destroyed. But it is really nice to personalize your own character. And so, yeah, that sticker sheet. And when you read the rule book, the only thing you think you're going to do with those stickers is put them on the character cards. But there might be other things that you use those stickers for.
What? Spoiler alert. I legitimately did not know there was anything else you could do with them. Oh, that's funny. I'm really excited to share this with people. We're going to be doing events at Origin. So if you want to stop by our booth, then you can definitely check this out. We're going to be playing it all the time, forever and ever, because Randy is awesome and is bringing a huge crew of people to help us out. So that'll be awesome. And you get to actually see what it looks like. And we, hopefully if the timing works out, cross your fingers for us, we'll have some for sale there too.
Yeah, so we got to get into the Kickstarter backers, but everything seems on track to have those for sale at Origin, hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's always a little bit stressful. Like, I totally am starting to understand right now, because we're doing our own Kickstarter for Overlight, the first one we've ever done. And just all of these little details that have to match up perfectly for everything to work out the way you want it to is crazy. Yeah. It is not like just putting out a regular game. But I think that this one looks like it's on track. We're really excited. I'm actually going to be taking this to an event I'm going to in 2 weeks called ACD Games Day, where I get to show it off to all of the best retailers in the country. We're going to be playing lots of different games, but definitely highlighting this one. And then your crew is taking it to Geekway to the West this next weekend as well.
If you'll be at Geekway to the West, you can find us there, and we'll be at BGG Spring. I'll be there personally. And then we'll also have people at KublaCon that same weekend, Memorial Day weekend, out in San Francisco. So if you're at any of those events, we'll have a copy. Now that I've got my first few copies in, we know we can have them there. So we'll have one to show off at each of those events.
But I really encourage anybody who does go and check it out, don't just play one game, because it's a cool experience, but it's not the experience you expect and not the experience you're going to get out of it after you've played several games. It really does remind me of other campaign style games that I've played, like Pandemic or Charterstone, where that first game, you're really just learning how it works and you don't get the experience that you would get once you've played it as a story.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think that's going to be a bit of a challenge at conventions, actually. So I know that at Origins, we're actually going to be doing longer demo events. Usually we try and keep our demos pretty short and to the point so people can get an idea and then move on quickly. But we're actually doing demos that'll be a couple games. Nice. So I think that'll be fun for people.
Yeah, during playtesting, we had at conventions, we usually had one group who would play a whole campaign just in one sitting. And that was really nice. I mean, the theme is light. You're playing neighborhood detectives, and I imagine a lot of families will play once a week or once a month. But in the gamer crowd, you can just sit down and play a whole campaign in one sitting. It'll be 4 or 5 hours, and we've had a number of people do that and just really love it. It's light enough and small enough that you can do that. If you're a serious gamer, you can definitely power through an entire campaign in one sitting.
I would challenge people to not play more than one game, because when you get to the end of the first one, you really want to keep playing. Like, I had that experience this weekend. I had a bazillion things I wanted to get done, but I really wanted to try this out. So my husband and I sat down and played one game, and I was like, we should really play another one. And then we got done with that one, and we're like, we have a little bit of time before it's absolutely too late to do the next thing. So let's play one more. And I can't wait to play the next two. And it was nice, like, we got to save our campaign right where we stopped, so we can come back to it and finish it up later.
Yeah, we thought a lot about how to do that. So it comes with a score pad. Let's show my score pad, where you log each case, what your score is, and which item you're recording for the next one. And so then the next time you start, what you're going to be unlocking, and you can just start right from there, which is a really cool experience. And we've got bags. It comes with plastic bags, enough for everybody to store their any cards that they may have. Campaign cards they may have associated with their character as you unlock new stuff. You keep those together with your character card and keep all those rules you've unlocked out so that you have them ready, and you can just keep playing when you start up again.
Awesome. So I did want to jump over to the chat and answer some of the questions that people have been asking from you. So one question we did have is any other ideas for lanterns or games from that universe? So of course we do have the one expansion. Anything else going on there?
Yeah, we have two other, three things that we're kind of working on in that universe. So they're probably all too early to announce officially, but you know, we love lanterns and it's, we've had a lot of people play it and love it. And so, you know, there is a market for that. So we have a few ideas, a couple of expansion ideas that we've play tested and people seem to really enjoy. And then a spin-off sequel type game that we're also working on.
Sounds exciting. I want to know more about that later.
Yes, I haven't talked to you about any of those, I don't think.
No, I don't think so.
I think Scott knows about all of those. But yeah, we'll have
That's probably true.
We'll talk about that offline.
I like it. That sounds good. There are a couple promo items. So if you're one of those people who likes to collect everything, there was a promo in the Santa's Renegades that was a snowflake. There's a promo that was the Foxtrot symbol, and then another that had the Renegade symbol, a crane, and what was the other one that was part of that set?
The tiger.
The tiger, that's what it was. Yeah. So those four came together, and then there's also a Game Boy Geek one, and what are the other ones? I feel like I'm missing one.
I think there's a Dice Tower one.
I was thinking there was a Dice Tower one, too.
I mean,
I think that might be it.
I think one of our foreign partners made a couple of promos that have some of their games on them. I'm trying to remember.
Oh, okay. I don't think I've seen those ones. That's fun.
I haven't seen them in real life, but files.
So. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. How many different languages is Lanterns printed in now?
I don't know for sure. Pegasus did the German copy, and they also did, they managed all of the EU copies. So I'm not sure even how many there are. I think the ones I've got on my shelf, I have Polish and German. There's Russian, Chinese, Dutch. I don't think I have a Dutch one. No. There's Russian, Chinese, and Dutch, at the very least.
Isn't there a Korean one?
Oh, yeah, maybe so.
I think it's the Chinese one that has a totally different cover, and it is gorgeous. It's not that Sobol art, but it's still very beautiful.
I think that's the Russian one that has the different cover. Yeah, a Russian artist did that, and it does look really good.
That's fun. Yeah, it's kind of neat. I like seeing all of our different games in different languages. It's kind of fun to know that they're getting to people all over the world.
Yeah, it's neat. And, you know, my brother, he's my business partner, and he's done a lot of creative work for the company. He did the logo, and it's not a font, you know, he hand drew all the letters. So for many of the foreign ones, he's had to redraw the logo.
He had no idea what he was getting himself into.
Exactly. All the Latin letter ones, he's hand drawn the logos in those different languages. And it makes for some interesting ones, because the German one is one really long word. Instead of just a shorter word like lanterns. And then like the Polish one is two words equally long. And so we sort of had to design a different layout. I mean, it's still similar, like it still feels like lanterns, but you know, in English it's lanterns big and then the harvest festival really small. And so we had to.
Do you want to show us the copies you have? You have a couple of them, right?
I do. Yeah. Let me grab them off the shelf. Hold on. I should have had them in hand. Yeah, let me grab those.
That's okay. I'm just bothering Randy now. And for all you guys in chat, if you do have other questions, I would love to have other questions for Randy. Anything about Spy Club, Fox in the Forest, also Sunday Split. We haven't talked about that one much yet, but I love playing that one with my family. It's super cute. It's a good I Split, You Choose game. And of course, World's Fair. Oh, good. We got some World's Fair questions for you.
All right. So here's the German one, Lichterfest, which I think means Festival of Lights, all as one word. And this I think is the French one. I do have the French one too. So this is the Polish one, which is two words, Festival of Lanterns, I think, Festival of Lights. And then this one was an easier one to translate. It just added an E.
It's very French. You just add some extra letters and it's French.
So this one was Madigo, and Pegasus coordinated that. So, And same with the Polish one. This is GFP and they reached out to me during the Kickstarter campaign about doing it and about doing the Polish version. And the Dutch one is the same. White Goblin Games reached out to me before we went to retail about doing that. And so then we had Pegasus do all of the EU copies for us with their different partners.
So are they in different size boxes? Because the EU has sort of a few different size boxes that they really like to use all the time.
Yeah, I think all three of these are the same size.
But they're all different from ours, right?
Yeah, yeah, they're all they're all bigger than ours.
Because there's so much value in that box.
I know. Well, they put different play times. Like this one's 30 to 45 minutes. This one's 45 minutes. And this one, ours is 30. So play times are always a tricky question. But yeah, they're bigger than our lanterns, and they are all the same size. They're thicker. Too, but it's been interesting to see the way the different publishers make them sort of feel like they fit in their catalog. Like, you know, Matigo has the their Matigo logo here on the front, and then the side is very different than our side.
Oh wow, yeah, that is
green side, and then Pegasus has its frame. You know, its frame and the Pegasus down in the bottom.
Yep. Neat. That's fun to see all the different ones.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've seen other games, but you don't know them as well as your own. So it's, you notice a lot of things when other people are doing it. You're like, hey, they put their green bar there. Or yeah, and Pegasus did a vertical side. I mean, the way we did lanterns, it didn't really make sense to have a vertical side, but they cropped
it. Oh, that's pretty.
They cropped it more or less like we crop it for the like our banners at conventions. It's that really thin look, so. Yeah, I think those are the only copies I have that are foreign. I do have a French World's Fair also.
Somebody was asking about World's Fair, actually, if you have any plans for expansions or updates to that at all.
We have one that we've been working on. It's a tricky one. I mean, a lot of the games that we do are very close to some self-contained, I'd say perfectly balanced. We try really hard to get, and those are the kinds of games we like, where they're very closed systems and they're not easy to expand. Lanterns took a lot of work, and another designer even besides me and Chris Chung, we had Jason, who worked with me on Spy Club. He came up with the initial idea for the Lanterns expansion and to really help us sort of think outside another level there to how those systems work. So the World's Fair one, where I'm not sure if it's gonna be big enough. It's small changes. Alex and I like small, subtle changes. So,
well, speaking of small, subtle changes, Board Games and Bourbon is asking for an H.H. Holmes expansion, which I would also greatly enjoy. if you in the audience haven't read Devil in the White City yet, please go and buy this book. It is so good, and it's all about the World's Fair in 1893. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I definitely recommend it. It's the first one I really read when I was digging into the theme for the research. So it's a really good, comprehensive source at a popular level that I got a lot of names and other books to read as we dug into the research there. About half of it is about Daniel H. Burnham, who is a character in the game. And the other half of the book is about H.H. Holmes, who was a mass murderer, the first mass murderer in America. And he saw the fair as a chance for lots of strangers to come to Chicago and get lost in the hustle and bustle of that summer. So, I mean, it's pretty morbid and it's fascinating in a crazy way. Yeah, so the H.H. Holmes expansion is probably the most popular requested expansion. We aren't particularly interested in that angle for the game.
I feel like it just needs to be a separate game.
There you go. Yeah, somebody did create a promo card where, I shouldn't even be saying this because it's so morbid, but when you... we don't make them. Someone just posted on BGG, but... you know, Daniel Burnham, when you play him, you get to add an extra supporter of yours to an area. When you play the H.H. Holmes card this person designed, you get to take off a cube from any area of your choice when you play it. So,
very thematic.
Yeah, it's very thematic. Again, that's just not the, doesn't quite fit the brand.
Well, There is that. Oh, hilarious. Pretty good though. So that was a good answer to that one. So I actually have another great question from John Shuttlers. He is asking, He says, you said development was your favorite part. Can you talk about how the games grow and change during development from the original versions you signed from designers?
So that's John, who is on the team.
You snuck him in there.
Yes, John helped a lot with designing the campaign content. So, yeah, I mean, it's one of the things, and Eric Lang actually just posted or did an interview on Ludology about development. If people are really interested in that, the kind of work they do at CMON, I think it sounds a lot like the kind of work we do here. So many publishers these days, it sounds like, sign games that they want to be completely ready. They just put art and ship them. And there are so many games coming out. The market is clamoring for new games that I can definitely see the business value of doing that, waiting until you find a game that's perfectly done and ready to go. The kinds of things we do, I mean, it's the part I love, so it's not the part I would skip. And because it's not my full-time job, I have another job that pays my bills. We can spend more time with games than we maybe otherwise could if we needed to. I mean, we do one or two games a year. That's all we do, and we co-publish them with you all right now. So, but we'll bring a game in, and we'll play it, you know, a bunch of times to see if it's really sparking, if we're feeling the magic that's there. And then we play test a lot with a lot of people. We have a network of play testers. So we'll do print and play, send them out, we'll take them to conventions and really try to find, you know, look at the vision of the game, look at what it does well and find ways we can make it do that more to bring out every last ounce of fun that we can. Sometimes we make really big changes to just see what will happen. And you know, oftentimes it's like, okay, well, that's too crazy, but we can now see how tweaking and tuning the game will push it this way, and it can help us bring out this one particular element a little bit more. In Spike Club, we had an example like that. We radically changed a lot of stuff, kind of got a really good sense for how it was working, and then rebuilt it back almost the way it was, but not quite. And that was like the key to getting that extra little bit out of it. You know, so a lot of play testing, a lot of trying things, a lot of experimenting things. One thing that Eric said in his interview that I really liked is that the design is setting the vision and getting a lot of those core mechanics to where the game is really fun. But trying to make it fun more often, more fun, more often, and trying to find all the crazy loopholes, the crazy distribution problems that might happen, and trying to squeeze every last ounce of fun that you can out of it. I mean, I can give you a couple examples from World's Fair that I think Alex has written about that are some really good examples of that kind of work that we do. So we had, when he pitched the game to me, he told me there was a problem with the distribution. There were 10 trigger cards. So if you know, the midways is what they became, but there are 10 things that move the game forward. And there was a problem that they could all clump at the beginning of the deck or towards the end of the deck. And you know, he had done some math simulations trying to figure out how to make that end up, you know, evenly. And we even considered stacking the deck at the beginning. And we're like, that seems like it's not the right answer. And then there was another kind of card. I mean, it was, we rethemed the game, so it's hard to talk about them. But there were these trigger cards, and then there were these midway cards. And we ended up combining the two of them together so that there were way more of them. So it's like, well, what if those cards that gave you 1 point also move the game forward, and instead of being 10, or if there were, I think it's 28 now. And so that got, you know, it fixed the distribution problems because it's way less likely that all 28 cards will clump at the beginning. And when we started incorporating with the theme is when we added the Ferris wheel as the thing that tracked them. So there was just a board of 10 spaces, and when you did four, it triggered a round, four more triggered another round, I think it was, maybe three. And so now we've got 28 of these in there. And we got 11 spaces before the round is triggered. And now it can be a Ferris wheel and the tracker can go around the board. So that's one good example. And I think another one from World's Fair is the people cards. Originally, they executed as soon as you placed them. So you place the cube and you perform the person's action right then. And so when you were deciding what to do, the person was part of that initial choice, where then we considered, you know, you get a hand of all the people cards, you can play whenever you want, but that really exploded the decisions that you had to make in the game. So we tried that and it definitely did not work. It was adding way too much complexity. But having them trigger on the next round so that they influence your next turn sort of added some depth to that. So instead of them defining what this turn means, it's like it modifies what my next turn could be. So I can play double wherever I play. That's going to help me make my next turn feel different, or I can play adjacent on the next turn. And also relates to triggering the end of the game, because you might want to trigger the end of a round or the end of the game before that other player has the chance to play the person that you know that they have. So those would probably be two examples from World's Fair about those kinds of things. Just lots of playtesting.
Well, that's what's so impressive to me is that you really did your homework on that one and spent a lot of time playing it, because I've seen a lot of Alex's prototypes and they're always just so freaking clean already. It feels like there's nothing else you could even do with them, but you guys played them enough and really dug into them to the point where you found these things that could just be a little bit more fun. And by the end, these games are just so elegant and beautiful, but it's complicated to fix them when you have so many connected parts, like all of Alex's games do. I'm super impressed. Like, that's development work right there in its purest form, and you guys just knocked it out of the park with World's Fair.
Yeah, and the key is in development is not taking the game and redesigning it, but working with reporting back the feedback. We probably do more of the trying to solve the problems that we find than any publishers or developers would do. I think just from what I talk about a lot, I think the more common model is that you'll report back to the designer and say, here are the issues we have. Let us know in a month when they're fixed. But Alex and I play the game. We set it up on a system called Roll20 that we use. It's meant for role-playing games. So it's like a kind of like Tabletopia or a tabletop simulator, but it's 2D. And I think it feels more like a prototype to me. So it feels more like it fits better with what we're doing. But Alex and I would play every week, for a couple of months there. And I still remember when I sent him the feedback from the distribution, I was like, this group had a terrible time. They must have had all of the, they'd messaged me in the middle of the game, says, what do you do if you run out of cubes? I'm like, how does that even happen? Like, what happened? And they reported their time, and we could tell the distribution was just terrible. Like, all the cards were in the second half of the deck. And so I send him this report, and he replies and says, what if we made the trigger cards and the midway cards the same? And I was like, now don't be hasty. We don't need to do something that dramatic. Let's just think about this. And then, like, the more I started thinking about it, it's like, that is it. Like, that is totally the way to do this. We don't have to make the trigger cards 1 point. We just combine these two types of cards.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of playtesting, a lot of listening to feedback, a lot of playing them ourselves. Spy Club, the campaign system, we play tested all the modules, which meant we also tested the base game, hundreds of times. I'm certain that Spy Club is my most played game ever in history. Not just games we've made, but all the games that I've ever played, just because, we worked on it for 2 years, a solid year of campaign content development and just playing it over and over and over, trying to find all the little things that could change. I mean, we got the base game, the core game, in a pretty good place after, the first year or so. Probably we did make a couple of changes after some feedback at Origins. We had a new idea for the movement deck that we got in place, but a lot of the core system has been in place for a very long time, which was important to build the campaign system on top of that.
So we actually had a few questions about Fox and Forest. First one was, is the name a nod to your game company name?
Not exactly. I mean, it sort of is in a way. So Josh had messaged me about pitching me this game, and he was talking about what the different characters could be. And he had the three, which let you change the Trump suit, but I think it was a different character at the beginning. But I said, that could be a fox because they're crafty and do unexpected things, and games with foxes in them go to the top of our submission queue. That's what I told you. So.
Note to self, if you're a designer out there.
I think when he pitched it to me, it was called Foxes, and that was our internal name for it for a while. We called it Foxes just internally. One of the people on the team calls it Fox singular now, and I'm like, that just doesn't sound right. I want to call it Foxes still. and the fox is a good character, and the artist also, she lives on a street that's like named Fox something, I think, like Fox Crossing. I think she moved there because of that. And
that makes sense.
She loves foxes also, and so it just all sort of seemed like it was a good fit.
Well, I remember when you started showing us the artwork and you had a different image for the cover of the box to begin with, and then you showed us the fox image and we were all like, holy crap, this one's amazing. This needs to be on the front of the box.
Yeah, that was a fun one too, because there's more art than is on the card, but she had just designed the card first. And the cards were all, you know, she had designed the full rectangular art for the card, even though we only used the oval part of it. You know, but we were like, oh, we just need a little bit more here. You know, just some more orange where we're going to put the logo. And she comes back with like adding in the branch and the trees on the side. And we're like, oh, well, the logo doesn't even now fit where we were going to put it.
Yeah.
So then we had to do something else. We asked her to change something else to like, we're like, well, we could put the logo here like this if you'll change this. And she did something different again. But like, it just all grew. So yeah, that picture started with just a fox with the orange background. And then it sort of grew in a couple of different iterations to be big enough for the box cover.
So Audi from our chat is wondering, so Eric Lane said Simon right now only wants to develop games with a physical table presence. So I guess that was probably when he was chatting in that methodology episode, which makes sense. Like lots of big miniatures on the table look really cool, but that's not the case with Fox and Forest, despite how popular it's been. It's really just a two-dimensional game. So what types of games does Foxtrot look to develop in the future is Audi's question.
Yeah, I mean, and Eric talks about that in the interview, that those are the kinds of games that they want to make, and they're trying to set themselves apart on that. And I think it's important for every publisher to have at least some kind of angle, like, you know, because otherwise you could just sign any game and every game, and to try to figure out what is it that you want to do. And I mean, that works, but as a small publisher putting out only one or two games a year, you know, we don't want to have a heavy Euro 1 year and then a light filler the next year. You know, I mean, if we were putting out 4, 5, or 6 games, we could probably do some of those every year. So our goal is to make, I mean, it says on our website, beautiful, approachable, and engaging games. And we're really trying to hit that, games that are easy to get into and are fun, but not kids games. You know, most of my great gaming experiences have been playing with my kids, but playing grown-up games or games that the kids are playing up a level instead of the grown-ups playing down a level. So, and we also really look for games that celebrate what's good in the world in some way. And so the World's Fair was a really good one, looking at all of the technical innovation, artistic innovation, and just the massive scale of that one. You know, that was a great, great theme for us. Most of our games are about real world people doing real world things. Fox in the Forest is a slight deviation from that. But it does celebrate the history of oral storytelling, and fairy tales are a big part of my background and education are around that. So even though that's not real world people doing real world things, it has a special place in my background. So yeah, beautiful, approachable, engaging games that celebrate something good in the world is probably what I would say.
Makes sense. One of our fans was asking about Fox in the Forest. I lost the question in here somewhere, but basically the point was that his mother, I believe, had bought it and was wondering if it would be appropriate for someone who liked euchre. And I've played euchre only once, but it does seem like, oh, here it is. My mom purchased the Fox in the Forest. Is it a game for euchre players? And I would say absolutely. And the thing I like about it is that I can play with just one other person because it's only a two-player game. And I grew up playing a ton of card games with my family, but they were always exactly four-person games like Bridge or Hearts or Spades. And it's frustrating when you now live with just one other person, like you can't play these games you want to play. So Fox in the Forest is great for that.
Yeah, and I love, behind Spy Club, my second most played game of all time is probably Spades. We played a 2- and 3-player variant of it when we were in a pinch and there weren't four of us. But yeah, Fox in the Forest, I would say yes. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that to really get it in that 2-player space. There needed to be a little more going on, a little more dynamic than just playing cards and seeing who has the higher value. But it does appeal in that sense to kind of the modern hobby gamers, because half the cards have a special ability that activates. So, you know, from what we've seen, it takes a little, you know, a game or two, a hand or two, I mean, to get used to the fact that the cards might change things, especially that the trump suit might change in the middle of the trick. That's the one that I think is the most surprising for people who are really familiar with trick-taking games. You play the card, you change the trump suit, and all of a sudden your card is trump over the other person's. But yeah, we definitely wanted it to feel like a classic trick-taking game, with just enough nuance and new stuff to appeal to hobby gamers, but to not be a completely foreign experience for people who are Euchre players.
Yeah, if you've played any trick-taking game, you already know 90% of the rules in this game, and the other 10% are written on the cards, which is really nice. I love the little like rules card that you have that makes it really easy, and yeah, it's just very straightforward. You hardly even need to open that rule book.
Yeah, the reference card was interesting because while all the cards do have their abilities on them, you might not have one of all of them in your hand, and so you might forget what the other player is capable of doing, and so having that reference card that has all six special abilities can help with that.
Yeah, very cool. Well, we are getting very close to running out of time. I did have a few more things I know our audience is very excited for. We're going to do a game giveaway. And the way that this works is I'm going to show one small item from one of our games. And the first person in chat to correctly recognize and name the game that that comes from gets to win a copy of it, and we will ship that to you. So everybody in the audience, you've had super good questions this evening, so get ready for this, and we'll see who gets to pick it first. And we'll have Steph watching very closely to see who gets it. So, all right, here we go. I'm moving it over. It's going to be a fast one, I think. This is a D4 with some very funky stuff on it. See who can figure that out first.
I assume I'm ineligible.
You are unfortunately not eligible, but luckily you received 10 copies of Spy Club today, right. So you're already good to go. Oh man, we had some super fast ones today. So I'm gonna let Steph decide which ones. Oh, Board Games and Bourbon disqualified himself. Well, that's lucky. So Kate Fung, you have the first full correct answer. Clank the Mummy's Curse is the right name for this. And this is a D4 that determines where the mummy is going to go after he is activated and then curse people who are there, unfortunately for them. So if you haven't played Clank the Mummy's Curse yet, that actually just came out about a month ago. You can try that out now. Speaking of games that just came out, Altiplano came out last week. And on May 2nd, what day is it? It's the 9th. Yes, so May 2nd. And if you haven't played that yet, it's a bag building game. It's a big, heavy Euro game with the most adorable alpaca on the cover that you've ever seen. And we are going to be showing that off at Origins as well. And we also have Lucidity, Six-Sided Nightmares, coming out on the 16th, and an expansion for Explorers of the North Sea called Rocks of Ruin coming out on the 23rd. So we have a ton of stuff coming out. We're super busy. Luckily, Randy does half the development for all of the games we care about. So that's lucky. We don't have to worry about that because we're too busy putting out other games. And then we also have Prowler's Passage coming out on June 6th. I don't believe we've announced that date yet. So you guys get to be the first ones to hear that. That just arrived in our warehouse yesterday. So we're all ready to start shipping that out to local stores. And then we're going to be at Origins, where we have a couple early release games, including Spy Club, which we'll be selling before it comes out anywhere else. We'll also have Junk Orbit and the T-Dragon Society for sale at our booth. So if you'd like, if you're going to be at Origins, please stop by our website. You can pre-order games with pickup for at Origins, and we'll have them there all ready to go for you. That will be super fun. And if you do stop by the booth, please see if any of Randy's crew is there. Some of them are in the chat this evening, so you can say hi to them and come and say hi to the amazing demo crew that we'll have there. So thank you guys so much. Unless anybody else has any really fast questions in the chat room, I think we'll be rolling off pretty soon. Anything else from you, Randy?
No, just real excited to get these games out there. It's so fun to when you get that first copy early and you open it and everything's amazing. It just looks real. So I can't wait to play with my copy and it'll be real exciting. We're just real excited for people to get to play this one.
And where can people find you after this interview?
Yeah, so foxtrotgames.com, Twitter is Foxtrot Games, Facebook is Foxtrot Games, where we have all our company announcements and things. And if you just follow me personally, see the behind the scenes of a computer programmer and indie publisher and husband and father. It's Randy Hoyt, my first and last name, R-A-N-D-Y-H-O-Y-T.
Fantastic. And one last little reminder that Steph posted in our chat is that we are doing a Prowler's Passage contest. We're giving away a copy of that right now. But our next contest is going to be for Spy Club. So we're very excited to give away a copy of that soon. And we'll get that going right away. So
you're not giving away one of my copies, are you?
Yeah, it was 10 copies. Oh no. Yeah, very soon we'll get a copy of that. And then when can people expect to see that on shelves?
I think July is our release date. We got to get it all through customs and to backers and all that. But yeah, I think July is our intended retail date.
That should be good. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us, Randy. It's been a blast. And thank you everyone in the chat. Thank you, Steph, for helping us. And we are going to be back on May 30th. Okay, I have to check to make sure that's the right date. Yep, May 30th. And our next guest is going to be Mandy Hutchinson from the Dice Tower. She's going to come and chat with us about being a reviewer and telling everyone how awesome Spy Club is. I'm sure that's what she'll be doing. So awesome. Well, thank you guys. I will see you in a few weeks.
All right, bye. Thanks.